so next up we have a talk on rewilding from Cara Fancy, who has an academic background in environmental philosophy and has worked for several years in conservation, mainly as a wildlife campaigner with the WWF. After spending a year in South America researching land rights issues and the local cultural significance of natural resources, Cara returned to the UK to start a PhD entitled Conservation in the Anthropocene within the Department of Geography at Plymouth University.
Sorry, I'm just trying to find my...
Sorry, I think I might have...
have I put it in the wrong one?
The timing of my introduction.
So, should I put it in... It's in that one, is that...
Is Jamie
do I need to open out through here, or do I open out through here?
Jamie's
gone. It's just not being very good at seeing the existence of USB drives.
Right, that's it.
There we go.
Here we go, that's it.
That's the one, thank you.
Okay. Is it looking okay?
Yeah, all good, thank you.
Okay, that's good, thanks.
Brilliant. And the title's changed slightly from what you've got down there, so bear with me. So in this session, I'm going to talk about some of the challenges to existing practices of nature conservation, and particularly the ways these are made more apparent in urban contexts. I use the example of a wetland system in northeast London to suggest how the urban context unsettles fixed ideas about nature and what counts as natural by highlighting the long history of dense human settlement and the implicit entanglement of human and non-human actors in a multifunctional site like this one. Here, conservation happens alongside water treatment works, angling endeavours, and multicultural minglings. What dictates the biogeography and wildlife in such a context? Who decides what lives are welcome or otherwise unwelcome? Why is it that some lives are more worthy of conservation than others? So how do I get through? Is that there again? Traditionally, nature conservation has been characterised by the Edenic sciences that support an idea of pure, pristine nature that needs to be protected and stewarded over. We need only think of national parks and protected areas, places like Snowdonia, Yosemite, the Serengeti, all modelled on an idea of wilderness, a concept that's received much criticism from environmental historians in recent years. Here, nature's authenticity is conceived of in the rural countryside, remote from people and commercial activity, and so the practice of ecological restoration, in almost all cases, focuses on the recuperation or recovery of a historical landscape located before a human-induced form of degradation or disturbance. But this traditional paradigm is being challenged by a new conservation frame that's gaining traction across Europe, known as rewilding. Rewilding can be understood as an open-ended experimental process that aims to support the autonomous lives of plants, animals, and their associated ecological functions. There are various forms of rewilding, creating some confusion among scholars and practitioners, but there are two central tenets that figure widely in rewilding debates, placing it as an interesting alternative to ecological restoration as conservation. These, which have been picked up by human geographers and other social scientists, concern the notion of non-human autonomy and the prospect of wild experiments that cannot make recourse to a singular nature. Non-human autonomy expresses a vision where plants and animals self-regulate and self-operate without the need of ongoing management by human actors. In contrast to other forms of ecological restoration, that are sustained through ongoing human stewardship. Secondly, the notion of a wild experiment recognises that in order to promote the autonomous lives and processes of non-human others, conservation rewilding will need to adopt an open-ended, experimental or iterative approach, and not all rewilding projects embody these central tenets, but helpfully scholars have suggested some examples where rewilding has gone a long way toward acknowledging the implicit entanglement of non-humans and humans in conservation endeavours and celebrate non-human autonomy as fundamental to the creation of experimental, forward-looking conservation futures. These include the Scottish Beaver Trial, which was developed on the premise that humans and beavers would have to coexist in an area of Mid-Argyll if the trial was to be a success, and the example of the Uswaardeplassen, a nature reserve in the Netherlands, which sits on land that was once reclaimed from the sea. It was initially designated for industrial development, but when plans fell through, it was gradually colonised by grey-legged geese, whose grazing behaviour created a novel grassland ecology that inspired conservationists to begin experimenting with a series of large herbivore reintroductions. Central to both of these examples is the way they highlight the relational aspect of conservation. Whether serving as a provocation or an inspiration, these geese and beavers prompted a series of human endeavours that allow for the co-production of surprising ecological futures. The features of rewilding described here present challenges to the kind of conservationist culture that territorialises distinctions between the natural and the cultural, the wild and the domestic, the native and the evasive, distinctions that cordon off what nature is, what it does, and where it's found. Such examples of rewilding recognise that nature, far from being timeless, pure and unchanging, and therefore discoverable and so recoverable, is instead emergent, enacted into being in sets of socio-material practices. And this opens up the possibility of locating the wild or wildness in peopled landscapes, in and with humanity itself. Recalling environmental historian William Cronin, if wildness can stop being just out there and start being also in here, if it can start being as humane as it is natural, then perhaps we can get on with the unending task of struggling to live rightly in the world. Speaking to this, geography scholars have noted how urban biodiversity has started to be accorded the kinds of conservation significance once reserved for rural and sparsely populated regions. Brownfield sites, for instance, have been widely cited as having an important role for urban wildlife. In fact, two of the UK's top sites for wildlife diversity are brownfield lands, supporting some of Britain's most scarce and threatened species. This, the act of recognising or valuing urban wilds, wilds that represent a far cry from the Great Plains of Africa, changes the terms within which nature has been traditionally conceived. Yet there's been little research into the specific implications of rewilding in urban environments. Urban environments represent some of the most altered landscapes on the planet. They're also at the frontier of socio-ecological issues and challenges, from climate change effects on biogeography and biodiversity, to the often unwelcome presence of many invasive alien species. The long history of dense human settlement means that distinctions such as native and invasive are less meaningful in cities. In fact, urban ecologists often have difficulty even differentiating as to whether a given condition or process is of human or natural origin. These conditions preempt or anticipate something of an Anthropocene future, a concept which has received much attention since it was first proposed as a new geological epoch by chemists Crutzen and Stormer in 2000. With the Anthropocene, it's no longer possible to imagine nature and culture as distinct ontological domains. Humans become major terraformers, and ecosystems become decidedly post-natural. Many ecologists now accept that ecosystems do not develop in linear, stable, and predictable ways through time, producing guaranteed fixed climax communities such as a forest. Future climate change scenarios only complicate matters further. So the Anthropocene as a concept, it catalyzes and brings to the fore the wildly unpredictable modus operandi of the more than human world, and as such has breathed new life into questions of nature. This presents novel challenges for conservationists regarding how and what to conserve when ecological baselines no longer make much sense. An interesting example of this, which reflects the hybrid geographies of urban Britain, is Walthamstow Wetlands, a reservoir system in London's Lee Valley, which is currently being transformed into one of the largest urban wetlands in Europe. The site is made up of 10 reservoirs that supply London with over 30% of its drinking water. As well as being an operational facility, it's a recognised haven for wildlife and a recreational site for anglers, being London's major fishery. These varying and sometimes conflicting interests make it a fascinating site for challenging the role of conservation, especially when history reveals how humans and non-humans have coexisted and co-fabricated the landscape for millennia. Fossil evidence reveals that the local area was once part of a vast primeval mosaic of forests and marshes, where wolves, ox, bison and elk roamed alongside early settlers who have farmed, hunted and battled since prehistoric times. Fast forward to the 19th century and the wetlands finds itself at the heart of industrial development in Britain, powering mills, housing factories and being the choice location for a new reservoir complex to supply Londoners with clean, safe drinking water, which was much needed after several outbreaks of cholera which killed thousands. Through the years, a host of wildlife has peppered this landscape, continually coming and going. In the last 40 years, a number of rare and vulnerable bird species have made a home here. From those typically associated with Martian habitats, such as reed bunting, willow warblers, grey herons, to a variety of overwintering birds, including tufted ducks, pochards, and shovelers. While in autumn, flocks of finches are found to be feeding on the seeds of the tall herbs. And all of this has led to the area being given Ramsar status as an internationally important wetland and designated as a triple SI in 1986, primarily for its nationally important bird populations, attracting bird watchers from far and wide. Another recreational activity that takes place at the wetlands is angling. The reservoirs have been home to the largest fishery in Greater London since the 1950s, regularly restocked with fish. Sports fishing might seem incongruous with nature conservation, but then so perhaps is a water treatment works. In 2010, the local council managed to secure a heritage lottery bid to transform the site into a distinctive urban wetland reserve, with improved access to nature, industrial and social heritage. This brought together a multiplicity of actors, anglers, architects, ecologists, bird watchers, water authorities and residents, to try to strike a balance between conservation and transition. And it should be noted that also this site is sort of very close to Walthamstow and Tottenham, which is undergoing a lot of gentrification and urban regeneration at the moment. And it hasn't been easy to strike this balance. An interesting example is the clash encounter between birders and anglers, which I'll briefly introduce. Since their arrival in 1991, families of cormorants have made a comfortable home at the reservoirs. They now comprise one of the largest inland colonies in Britain, with over 1,000 individuals. Their colonisation isn't entirely random. As seabirds, cormorants like fish and they're good at fishing. A combination of lack of food on British coastlines, the result of overfishing, and an easily accessible supply of fish at the reservoirs have brought cormorants here and kept them here. They've completely transformed the ecology of the reservoir islands, now dubbed the Cormorant Islands. They look dry and treeless, creating something of a guano effect, much like the cliff faces they might normally inhabit. But the ingenuity is not winning over the angling community. In fact, many anglers would like to see their numbers culled because they're taking fish that anglers would normally land, albeit to then put them back. But birders and conservationists are welcoming them for the time being, not least because they represent a nationally significant inland colony. And they also eat the invasive, we've talked about invasive, but here they are, the invasive American crayfish, which neither the conservationists nor the anglers seem to like very much. So this is just an example of some of the issues conservationists now have to navigate in urban environments. As the site looks to a public opening next year, what will be their guiding principles? How will species be judged? On their rarity, their indigeneity, their ecological role perhaps, or simply their charisma and their ability to draw in the crowds? So over the course of this research, I hope to answer some of these questions by examining how and why certain conservation decisions are made and then experienced within the complex hybrid ecologies of urban Britain. The hope is to unwork some of the cultural and political factors influencing these decisions and locate a more meaningful environmentalism relevant to the urban context. The dynamic hybrid geographies of urban Britain demand a new politics for nature conservation, one that accounts for the lively temporalities and fluid geographies of wildlife. Rewilding, when informed by the central tenets of non-human autonomy and experimentality, can help bridge this gap, prompting a re-engagement in the politics that is obstructing opportunities for getting along well or better with all non-human others, and locating pathways for what Hinchliffe and Watmore have called a politics of conviviality in the city. So thank you. Happy to take questions.